The year that this week's album debuted saw more sequels hitting theaters than the years prior. Wikipedia has the number at 28. Some of those gems include Cars 2, Electric Boogaloo, Diary of a Wimpy Kid 2, Too Wimpy Too Kid, and Alvin and the Chipmunks, Chipwrecked. This week's artist goes by a succinct, one-word stage name, but his real name is Finn Greenell. I know it probably seems like I'm giving away a lot by giving out his full name, but if you know, you know, you know. A single four-letter suffix is all that separates this week's album with a Nintendo 64 game commonly viewed as the spiritual successor to GoldenEye 007. The year was 2011, which makes its second appearance in our podcast. This week's artist joins Bono, The Edge, Sting, and Pink in the one-named artists club, Fink. And finally, for the nerds, this week's album is Perfect Darkness, not to be confused with Perfect Dark, the video game. Today on Two Dudes and Tunes. Listening to Two Dudes and Tunes, the podcast that has so far weathered the busy storms of the lives of its hosts. I am Chris Robinson, one of the hosts bailing water out of the bottom of this dinghy. My good co-host is Wood Johnson, who I imagine is the one frantically paddling. Wood, how are you doing?
Do you hear banjo music? Paddle faster. Nah, man, I'm doing okay. I mean, we're both getting over a little bit of illness. It's been a couple of weeks since we recorded, and just life's been crazy. So what's new with you?
Oh, man. Let's see. Well, I've been... Yeah, listeners, here's a peek into the lives of your hosts. These show notes that I have written out are 2 weeks old. That's been how long it's been since I typed these up. So my notes are out of date, and I'm floundering here. But... getting to play some music for money. That's good. That's continuing to happen, which is nice. I guess McKinsey is not tired of me.
Nice.
Screwing things up from time to time. Here's a note here. So there are three bits of media that I want to recommend. Because, you know, when you're sick, the only thing you really do is sit and consume media or puke, depending on how sick you are. But I've been watching, I actually binged the entire series of Doom Patrol, which is like kind of like a brassy, irreverent, it's like based on a kind of a more obscure DC comic book series. Mm-hmm. And it's a bunch of like misfit heroes. It's kind of like a X-Men, Professor X type thing, except for they all cuss a lot and have really messy interior lives. It's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And also Brendan Fraser is a voice actor on that show, and it is just the best. He plays this like, he plays the brain of like an 80s NASCAR hero, who was like in a car accident and his brain got shoved into this like really clunky, like 50s looking robot. So that show has been a lot of fun. Definitely not for kids. So if you're looking for an advisory, like this is it. Let's see. Oh, one of the things I binged an audiobook version of a novel called The Cold Dish, which listeners might recognize better as the TV show Longmire. Mm-hmm. It's the Longmire series. And you actually, I'm pretty sure you recommended that to me like 1,000 years ago. And I finally got around to like listening to that book, and it was fantastic.
I distinctly remember recommending it to you, and I'm pretty sure I gave you The Cold Dish when you lived here in San Antonio, which would have been years before it was a TV show.
Yeah.
And I love those books. You mentioned this to me in text probably 2.5-3 weeks ago or whatever, and yep, I dug into my Audible library and re-downloaded them all to my phone. And in the time since then, I have listened to the first 6 of the novels.
Oh, man. You are plowing ahead. So, yeah, so here's how I know you didn't give me that book to borrow is because I would still have it in my library because I never give books back to people. I'm terrible with that. Listeners, if you ever see me, don't give me any of your books because I'll keep them.
But I'm glad you're into it. It's such a great series.
Oh man, so for one thing, it makes me want to go to Yosemite,
yeah,
or like go out to Wyoming, because the way that I can't remember the author's name, but the way he
Craig
writes,
Johnson,
yeah, the way Craig Johnson writes the descriptions of the like Wyoming countryside is just so evocative, and it's also like green and mountainous, which is the exact opposite of Lubbock, Texas. So it makes me long for the West.
The thing I really enjoy about him too is he writes really smart characters and really good dialogue. Like his dialogue is really believable.
Yeah, it's such a fun world to live in when all the characters, like the characters have kind of the snappiness and intelligence of like kind of the way you like Quentin Tarantino characters feel, but they feel a lot more realistic.
Mm-hmm.
They're that smart, but they're also a little bit more kind.
Yeah. They're not a caricature. Like a
yeah, exactly. But they're that, they're that like snappy and quick with their responses, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So that's then item number three, the third bit of media. I think I said I was enjoying three bits of media. The third one is some actual music. I think it's been a long time since I've said like, hey, I have an album I'm listening to that you should check out. And since this is a music podcast, thought I'd bring it up. But that album is The Killers' newest album, Pressure Machine. It's Brandon Flowers. I was going to say friend of the podcast, but he's more just like
dear friend of the show,
Brandon, good old Brandon. But he talks about the whole album is an examination of small town life in, I can't remember the name of the town in Utah that he grew up in. Is it Utah or Nevada? He's a Mormon.
He grew up in Nevada, I thought. All of his music is about Vegas.
I think you're right, because they're from Vegas. I just know that he also like has a Mormon faith, and so I just assume like, oh, he must just be from Utah. But it's you and I have talked about how little we like Bruce Springsteen for the most part. But this album has like a really good Springsteen feel to it, like what you kind of wish Bruce Springsteen's music was.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a little bit of REM in there as well. The opening track is a real banger. Like that was the song that got me like continuing to listen to the album. And then also the guys from the band Dawes, they did some background vocals and they have just killer harmonies. If you ever listen, we'll get to a Dawes album because it's on my list. But yeah, that's basically the new things in my life are all items of media because I'm a true American.
Well, yeah, exactly. So while I was down with the sickness, this week, I started watching a show called Yellowstone on Peacock.
Oh, nice.
And holy crud. I mean, we'll go ahead and put the disclaimer here. It is definitely not family friendly. But it is so good. Definitely check it out if you're looking for something to binge watch.
That's Taylor Sheridan, right?
Yes. Sons of Anarchy and a bunch of other stuff.
He is another guy whose work, like if he's involved with it, I'll watch it. I haven't, he put out a movie on HBO Max that I haven't seen yet.
Which one? Called
Those Who Wish Me Dead.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's the one where, Angelina Jolie has to protect one of her 1,000 adopted children from being murdered by oil men or something. Like, I don't know. I don't know what the movie's about. Anyway, I'm sorry. I interrupted you to throw around my movie knowledge.
No, it is Taylor Sheridan, and it's just a phenomenal series. It's very graphic. I mean, it's definitely it's definitely
Kevin Costner, right?
It's got Kevin Costner. It's got a great ensemble cast. It's basically following a rancher whose family owns the largest ranch in the world or in America. And his basically fights, basically the world, and his fights with the Native American tribe that's on one border of his property and the over leveraged land developer who's trying to turn, Wyoming into, like subdivisions, and then the state government as well. And he's kind of like an anti-hero. Kevin Costner's kind of the main character. And he's not a great guy. So you don't necessarily like him, but you can kind of understand where he's coming from. And I'm only about a season into it. The fourth season debuts in December, I guess, or late November. So I'm trying to get caught up by then to see what happens with him. So I can be caught up.
How behind I am is that I thought that this show had come out like last year or the year before.
I had known it was out and just hadn't had time with school and with everything that I had going on in life and being in bed and with nothing else to do. I watched it on my iPad and I was unable to turn it off. So definitely worth checking out.
Well, I'm going to have to check that out. I've been enjoying the like modern Westerns that I've kind of tripped and fallen into. And it's a fun genre to me. So
yeah,
I'll have to give it a look.
Well, I like the time. Anytime you've got a character that's like trying to hold on to the old way of life. So like Walt Longmire, the guy is wearing his, you know, Carhartt cowboy jacket and his 10X Stetson, and he's carrying a .45 that's 100 years old, and his weapon
doesn't own a cell phone.
Doesn't own a cell phone, drives an old beat up truck, and uses a lever action rifle from Custer's Last Stand as his duty rifle. Man, it's like
so great.
That's my guy. I love that.
Yeah, that is like catnip for people in our age demographic. Is just like, yeah, stick it to the man with cowboy ways. Heck yeah.
Well, and I just absolutely love like his assistant deputy, and then also his best friend in that show or in that book, Henry Standing Bear is just so good. So,
AKA Lou Diamond Phillips,
Lou,
who whenever I talk about the movie La Bamba, which is often because I like to poke fun at it, I never remember that it's Richie Valens. I always just like, oh, that's that movie with Lou Diamond Phillips in it, right? Poor Richie Valens. He deserves better than my stupid self cracking wise about him.
It's all good. Well, hey, man, I think we have drained the swamp proverbially in small talk. You ready to talk about Perfect Darkness?
Absolutely. Let's get into it.
All right, Chris. Perfect Darkness, June 13th, 2011. Why don't you take a couple minutes here and tell me how this made it onto your list?
All right. Well, if you are playing Two Dudes and Tunes Bingo, you probably have access to the beta because we haven't released it to the public yet. So congratulations on that.
What is our free space, Chris? What is our free space at the center?
I don't know. I don't know. Like
every time we joke that this is free,
Moby album. Oh yeah, there you go. That's the free space has to be jokes about that. You get what you pay for. It's the space should just say you get what you pay for, and people can just put that down.
There you go.
But if you're playing, in addition to your free space, put a tile on the spot marked Megan or my wife or college. We probably decided on a spiffy name for that tile by now. But she had been listening to Fink just in general, plenty of time before she had met me. She kind of discovered the album at like a Starbucks in Colorado back when they used to have like CDs of whatever was playing, you know, CDs, those little shards of plastic with ones and zeros. But yeah, she had his album before this one, maybe a couple of them. But I just remember being struck by the kind of the mood and atmosphere of his music and this album in particular. And well, another square we need to put on our bingo chart is Sense Memory, because I always associate this album with like fall and winter, Christmas and that kind of thing. Not that it has anything to do with that. But we got married in 2012, summer of 2012, May 20th, 2012. I do still remember. And I was still in school at the time. So Megan was working at the elementary school near our house, and she would have the car and I would walk to school because we were renting this just really run down, cut rate, married student apartment. And so I would put some headphones in and walk a couple blocks to class. And I don't know, I just listened to this album a lot during that time. And it is kind of a more chill album. It's really more relaxed kind of vibe. I listen to the Fink Pandora Station a lot if I want something not too sad sack, but also not super peppy either. It's kind of like a nice middle ground. And so that's kind of where this album came from for me. It was one of the many artists that my wife turned me on to, and it's just lasted. It's got staying power for me so far. We've been married nigh on to 10 years next year.
Nice.
And haven't been tired of it. So that's where it came from for me. I kind of teed this album up poorly for you. Did you wind up hating it, or did you need like a box of tissues and some Prozac? What was the deal?
You know, it's funny. We joked about or have joked about in the past about how my albums appear to be things that you're pretty much familiar with rare occasions for things that you didn't know about. Whereas when we come to your list, the albums that come up 90% of the time, I don't even know who the artist is, let alone what the album is about. And I've noticed that there's a trend on your albums over the course of this series, and that is they all have like darkness in the title of them.
Yes, this is real music. Dark, brooding, important, groundbreaking.
And they all have the same exact graphic art design, which is like this blue green hue and some sort of shape to it. And this album, you know, when it came up, I mean, I think the last album of yours we did was Dark Horses. And now we're on to Perfect Darkness. So it was kind of funny to me that we've tread on this theme before, I think, Chris. And so I was a little apprehensive at first when I popped this thing into Spotify and saw the album artwork and saw the names of the titles of the songs. I was like, oh boy, here we go again. And thankfully it did not end up being a how did we do this again? Like what's Chris's problem? That wasn't
why did I start this podcast with this Moby loser?
Well, and to pull the curtain back, another tile that we use a lot apparently for our bingo game, to pull the curtain back, it's been like a month since you and I recorded just because of the way life has been.
Oh man.
And so this album has been on my playlist of things that I listen to stay in the mode of preparing for a podcast for a lot longer than some of the other ones you and I have done. So I've had, but that's a good, that's a good thing though, because I've had a lot of time to come to terms with this album. And I agree that, the idea that it is not really a sad sack kind of album, it is a much more mellow contemplative album, but it's not a woe is me album, which is kind of where I draw the line. Anyway, so yeah. I really, really love this album for a lot of reasons. I learned a lot about Greenall as a musician and as a artist through the course of the past couple of weeks, listening to some of his other work and reading about his creative process that made me really respect him as an artist on top of all of that. One of the things about this album that I don't think I saw in your show notes is just the fact that he and his band got together after live shows on tour and had jam sessions, and they recorded these jam sessions and ended up with about 30 different soundscape ideas that ultimately got synthesized down into this album. And the fact that this was the first album that he had done with his band that was so collaborative, that it was just them with no pressure after a show playing in the bus while the stage was being broken down and coming up with ideas that would become something. And this album kind of captures that organic soundscape feeling. I mean, one of the things I'm sure we'll talk about is just how warm and expansive this album is across its entire track list. There is not a track that feels left out here, and they all just are big tracks without being over the top and, you know, grunge super hits.
Yeah, the tone of it, I think, is really interesting because Greenall was a DJ. Mm-hmm. You know, he, before doing this alternative folk, before kind of turning that into his MO, he was a DJ. And I think that that is probably what gives this album such a unique kind of warmth and textures, all the soundscapes. It doesn't surprise me at all, actually, to hear that him and his band kind of took a more textural approach to just jamming on some ideas and recording a bunch of them, because each track has its own kind of unique vibe. Like, of course, each song has a musical hook, right? Like a musical idea that repeats that you listen to. But beyond that, each one definitely has its own feel. One of the things I really love about this album is that one of the biggest sounds in it, one of the biggest textures in it, is nylon string guitar. Mm-hmm. That's something that is all over this album. And I enjoy it because it's so refreshing from the standpoint of being folk music. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's interesting that you use the phrase folk music, because this is a real interesting hybrid of, I don't even know what you want to call it, but it's got folk elements without being what I would consider actually folk music.
Yeah, I think I'm probably oversimplifying a bit. And in fact, looking at my Apple Music app, it's under the alternative genre. But alternative doesn't mean anything. There's not nearly enough specificity. I imagine if you looked it up, if you just Googled Fink, it would probably come up as alternative folk.
Mm-hmm.
But I think some of the... some of the lyrical content and even some of, like, at least one or two of the songs could be considered folk from the point of view of being, you know, romantic ballads or, you know, some kind of vaguely hinted at political statements. But it is definitely kind of stretching the boundaries of what we would call folk, because, you know, like, we've done a Bob Dylan album. Mm-hmm. On this podcast, we've done the soundtrack to A Brother, Where Art Thou, which is about as, like, true to life
real folk as it gets.
You can get. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so I think sometimes discussions about genre are maybe a little not pointless, because the whole reason that we discuss genre is to kind of identify a thing. It's descriptive. It's not proscriptive. Mm-hmm. But all that is to say, it's the thing I love the most about this album, that it is this kind of strange synthesis of acoustic guitar, but also kind of the musical songwriting instincts of a band being fronted basically by a DJ, or at least a guy whose most formative years of music were spent DJing music.
Yeah.
You know, there are some kind of electronic dance music grooves in some of these songs. Honestly, as kind of down tempo as that song is, honestly has like kind of a nice like driving four on the floor thump to it that you associate with, you know, kind of the dudes from Night at the Roxbury, you know, bobbing their heads on the like,
yep,
that kind of thing. And there's just a lot of interesting kind of out of left field things in this album in general. There's a lot of orchestral strings on this album. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that I always like, but for whatever reason, the arrangements on this album really, really get me as far as like what I'm looking for if there's going to be an orchestra, you know, accompanying whatever song you happen to be performing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Chris, about the orchestration. One of the things that I kind of picked up on listening to this album over the last couple of weeks was just the cinematic kind of nature of the soundscapes in here. And I got a lot of Chris Nolan kind of vibes. You know, he's a director who's world renowned for using really big sound effects and really big soundscapes and really simple orchestration to get big ideas across. I mean, you think of Inception, you think of Tenet from last year. His movies just have big sound and big, big orchestration that kind of brings you into the story. And I felt like the orchestration on this album was used kind of in a similar way that he uses orchestra.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these songs, I think that's one of the things I love about this album is that the storytelling is not just limited to the lyrics, which it can be in more traditional folk music. You know, the music is there kind of like we've talked about before, just as like a bedrock for whatever the singer has to say. But there's, you know, you brought up Christopher Nolan. There are some really Hans Zimmer type of moments in this album. The tune Fear is Like Fire had some really driving guitars that kind of reminded me a little bit of some of the stuff from the Dark Knight trilogy. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the like noisy guitars and feedback and stuff like that. And even just some of the like really atmospheric stuff, I'm not sure if it's synth or just effects or one shot effects or what, but all the stuff on Warm Shadows was a lot of fun to me. There's like, I don't know if it's like a phaser or a flanger or something, but you know, there's something weird going on with the acoustic guitars in that track that give it kind of a, almost kind of like a watery feel.
Mm-hmm.
But there is so much cinematic moments, so many cinematic moments in this album that I really enjoyed. But I want to pivot a little bit to Finn Greenall himself. His voice is gorgeous.
Yes, that, it is.
He's got this like kind of sultry, soulful thing going on. It's one of those things, like there are a lot of songs that I have listened to for a long time that I can, if I'm singing along with it in the car or whatever, I can kind of match the cadence. Like pretty much anything from Pink Floyd's catalog, I've heard so to the point where I know the cadence of what David Gilmour, Roger Waters is going to say. And even some of the like fun British accent that especially David Gilmour sings with, I've got down to where I can like sing along with it. But Greenall has this, like, he's behind the beat a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You'll hear people talk about that being the thing that makes a musical line or a part or a groove for a drummer soulful, is their ability to be consistently a little bit behind the beat.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's just real expressive. The track Honesty is very just like blue-eyed soul. You know, the music isn't necessarily R&B, but what his voice is doing is, I think. And then the track Wheels, I really love because it's probably the closest he gets to traditional folk, you know. It's very much like an old, like, Delta blues tune just dressed up by this guy in England.
Yeah.
Yeah, Greenall is just a very kind of flexible musician. He does his own thing, but he's capable of all those different kinds of modes of singing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find that is probably something that keeps me coming back to his music. Is that I get a little something different with each song.
Yeah.
He's not rehashing the same kind of thing over and over again.
Well, one of the things I have to say, you know, we've talked about it before too, with like the likes of John Mayer and Dallas Green and some of the other musicians that are on your list. He has a certain effortlessness in how he portrays himself vocally. He doesn't feel like he's being pushed too hard or too far or trying things that he's not comfortable with. And there's something I like hearing artists who push themselves. So don't get me wrong here, but there is something that I find reassuring and comforting from a musician who sounds like they're doing something that they can just do and they're not having to be too, you know, cutting edge in their own talents. And for the type of album that this is, it's a wonderful compliment. This isn't Weezer and punk rock trying to figure out what they're doing, you know, and throwing everything against the wall vocally and instrumentally. This is a guy who knows who he is, what he's doing, and what he's here to accomplish. And it's an album that, because of that, and because of the tone that it has taken, despite the multifaceted ways he can, you know, express himself, you still get this feeling of a person who knows who he is and what he wants to do. And that's reassuring to somebody who maybe doesn't. You know, when I'm sitting around going, what do I want to do with my life? Or what am I doing right now? Well, this guy's got it together. Let me listen to him for a little bit.
Well, and I think the thing that really explains what you're talking about is that he turned to this kind of musical project after getting tired of being a DJ. I don't know if I explicitly said that, but in all the research I did, he turned to this project because being a DJ was just not fulfilling. And so I think there's a lot of confidence that goes along with not only knowing, like, okay, music is what I want to do, right? Because he had figured that much out.
Mm-hmm.
But he got along far enough in life to go, ah, this isn't quite what I want to be doing. And so I think that kind of confidence and assuredness creates a lot of consistency. I heard a quote the other day, and I wish I could attribute it correctly to the jazz musician who said it. I think it might have been Ornette Coleman, who's really fantastic out there, sax player. But he said it took him close to 30 years to know what he wanted to play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a challenging thing to wrap your head around, especially for me. You know, I'm 32. I haven't been playing music for half that long.
Mm-hmm.
And so to really sit down and reckon with the fact that it may take me quite a while to really get into like what makes me artistically satisfied and comfortable is kind of daunting, but I think being okay with that journey helps you get there with a little less pain and suffering. And I definitely think that here with this album, we are hearing somebody who's hit that stride, gone, okay, like, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how it's going to be. And I agree, it's consistent overall. You mentioned the warmth of the production. All of this is, none of the tracks, I've said this before, so I'm being repetitive, but none of the tracks on this album are. And yet they have kind of a consistency that I think is really refreshing. Because there are a lot of musicians that, you know, will cast around from one song to the next for different styles, and that's fine. You know, like you were saying, I enjoy hearing somebody push themselves and go out on an edge. But at the end of the day, I think the artists that have the most success are the people who don't need to reinvent themselves constantly.
Yeah. Well, and there's not a whole lot of information on this album, you know, other than the fact it was recorded in about a space of 20 days and, you know, a couple of just those really compact things. But I wanted to bring up the producer on this album, who is kind of everywhere in music. And I believe we've talked about him a couple of times before, and that's Billy Bush, who is a record producer out of St. Louis, Missouri. He has done all sorts of stuff with all sorts of big rock bands over the last, you know, since about 1996 when he came into the world of music. And he's credited with being the producer, recording engineer, and the final mixer for this album. So he basically is the, you know, the fourth band member, if you will, kind of back there in the background on this album and on Fink's subsequent album after this in 2014. So I wonder how much of his kind of tonal control kind of fed into this, because he's got a lot of other acts that are similar in nature as well.
Yeah, he does. I'm looking here at his Wikipedia, the band Garbage.
Yeah.
Which, not to be confused with the refuse in your trash can.
He started with Garbage as a guitar tuner for the band and ended up as their road manager, and as their they asked him to revamp their equipment because they had a whole bunch of technical glitches on the road with their PA system and their playback stuff. And so he revamped all of that. He went from guitar tech to basically live event engineer to then their production engineer and then producer and mixer. So,
that's fantastic.
But all from being a guitar tech.
Yeah, he's worked with some very, very varied, very varied.
His most recent album was a Dolly Parton album, everybody.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So Dolly Parton, Paul McCartney, let's see, Lupe Fiasco, who I think is a rapper. I'm old, don't get mad at me, young people. Dweezil Zappa, a band called the Boxer Rebellion, Tegan and Sarah. So he seems to be able to help people find what they want instead of just like, this is my style and you must make a record in this fashion. And that may very well be one of the secret sauces in this album.
Yeah.
Because boy, is it really is good. And I didn't come up with a ton of examples of lyrics that really caught my attention, although I really do enjoy Finn Greenall's work as a songwriter. But the one kind of quote that I have from the song Berlin Sunrise is, fall into your lover's arms and remember those whose lover's arms are closed. Like really, really beautiful melancholy sentiments, I think, in that song specifically. But throughout, you know, it's not an overtly sad album, but he is an Englishman, so
hey, it's cloudy 52% of the time, so you know.
Yeah, exactly. There's not enough weather to make them super chipper happy people. But yeah, do you want to move on to the critical reception before we kind of give our review of this thing?
Yeah, but before we do, I did want to mention my favorite chorus from this album.
Oh, yeah.
Which is actually on the opening track, Perfect Darkness. Uh-huh. And there's something about the way he vocalizes this verse. But the line goes, feel the night air in perfect darkness, babe. Perfect darkness is all I can see. Deep water, stay under. See it rolling over your head. Just roll with it until it's all good.
Yeah.
And the way his voice undulates through that is kind of like water, kind of like you were saying earlier. And it's so great.
It really is. Yeah. And that's a thing that I think is missing from, I don't want to be that guy who's like, that's what's missing from music today.
Like, you're that guy. Go ahead.
I'm going to be that guy. One of the things that kind of bugs me as a songwriter myself trying to do these things is, when you hear emphasis on words that are basically meaningless when it comes to the text of what's being sung, mm-hmm. Sometimes people will be, if you have a line that has like a couple articles in it or whatever, sometimes people wind up hammering like the word the or there's a kind of carelessness with which some people write lyrics sometimes. Mm-hmm. But that you just described, his attention to detail and the way he is expressive with the words that he's singing, the kind of word pictures that he's creating with them, with it, not only the words he's saying, but his delivery is really great. It's really good songwriting.
And it's not just the word pictures. It's the fact, I think, that his syllables line up with the music so well. This is the word I need to use here, but this is how I need to pronounce the syllables of that word to make it fit what's happening in this song right now. And that's just something I don't think I've been cognizant of before in anybody's music. Yeah. So it was pretty refreshing from that standpoint for me.
Yeah. Another example that's coming to mind, I want to bring up real quick before we hit up the reviews. In the song Honesty, he says, you've got so many colors. You're like, I won't use the actual word, but you're like an effing rainbow. Just let me revel in your blue. And then there's a pause. He has a rest where he is reveling in the person he's talking to in the song. Revel in your blue. Rest. Notes and stuff like that is like, really, you don't notice it maybe the first, second, or third time you listen, but the more you listen to music like that, really good music, the more it kind of jumps out at you. And so I just think it's another mark in this album's favor, I would say.
I had missed that one entirely, but now I'm gonna go listen to it and listen for it.
That one is awesome. That is one of my favorite songs on this album. It's not my favorite. We'll get to my favorite soon enough. It's one of my favorites on this album.
Awesome. Well, Chris, I think we need to give this thing some critical reception. All right. So Metacritic gave this 69 out of 100 on seven reviews, and 7.4 was its user score out of five ratings. Pretty small sample size. One of the things that I will say in looking at Fink's listenership on Spotify, since they publish a lot of numbers, I was pretty bummed to see how little he's actually listened to. You've got all these, big rock groups that are getting millions and millions of views every month, and he's down in the, 100,000, 125,000 a month kind of category. And that's a huge disservice to the music industry.
Yeah. It's very odd, too, because if I'm not mistaken, he's had at least one song on The Walking Dead, mm-hmm. which that's not like the mark by which we grade all musicians. But it's not as though his music isn't out there. I would be real surprised if one of his songs wasn't on like Grey's Anatomy. It was, his music came out kind of around the time that shows like that. Heck, but one of his songs is probably on Chuck, mm-hmm. Because Chuck has really great music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's an underrated show.
And you know, the thing is, Megan and I keep looking for shows of his to go to, and they're all in England. Yeah. So it may just be that he's just kind of an English phenomenon. And
by the way, I did have to mention this. I did have to mention this.
Oh, yeah.
He is the most badass looking motorcycle dude I have ever seen. Like, I'm sure, like, he's got the look. And on top of being English, it's like, man, talk about fist to authority.
Yeah, he's a rowdy looking dude, but man, does he make some great music. So some of the reviews, actually both of the reviews that I dug up were, surprise, surprise, from British publications. Carolyn Sullivan of The Guardian gave this album 4 out of 5 stars. And it's a little bit of a lengthy quote here, but I'm going to go ahead and read it anyway. An organic warmth prevails on even the most emotionally chaotic songs. Delicate finger picking and squeaking guitar strings sweeten the scathing honesty, while his hungover rasp on Berlin Sunrise paints an oddly seductive picture of the new day. And I just thought, I mean, she says literally warmth, you know, mm-hmm. She brings up the warmth, the organic warmth of this album. Ian Wade of the BBC had kind of similarly glowing things to say. A writhing, surprisingly meaty addition to the overcrowded singer-songwriter genre. It has enough individuality as to not get brushed aside with the prefix just another. And that's really, that's the thing that I think sums up this album, is that I don't know that you could fairly call it groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it doesn't push any envelopes. But when you compare this, especially to a lot of the kind of stomping, clapping your hands, group vocals nonsense that went on in indie music, it seemed like for all of the 2010s, mm-hmm. you know, there was a Mumford & Sons clone born like every minute. His music doesn't fall into that category. And that's not a dig against Mumford & Sons. I love that band. But
imitation is the best form of flattery until it isn't anymore.
Yeah, until it leaks money out of your bank account, which actually happened, I think, to Mumford & Sons. They kind of found that they were losing ground because their style had been copied. But that's an entirely different episode. So we've kind of gone over the critical reception. Would you like to remind our viewers of our review scheme and give this album a rating?
Yeah, absolutely. So ever since the very first episode of this show, Chris and I had decided to rate and review our albums individually on a 1-6 guitar string model. One string being just an absolutely terrible album that should have been left on the cutting room floor, and 6 being one of the greatest albums you've ever heard. I will say that model may be just a little bit biased because we're picking albums from our favorite lists. So the statistically, we're not playing fair on that front. If we were just doing new music, I think the rating system would be better. But hey, it's all in fun anyway.
You get what you pay for. Go ahead and put that chip on your bingo card.
So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and give my review first, so that way you can have the last word on it. Thankfully, we're not going to fight too much. I'll say that much.
No, not this time around.
So like I said earlier, when I saw the name of this album, saw the artwork on it, I was like, great, another friggin' self-indulgent, depressing album on Chris's list. My first album to this list actually verified that feeling. I was driving to Houston for some business-related issues that I've been having out there, and it was raining, and it was dark outside, and this album's just kind of plodding along, and about halfway through the album, I was like sitting in totally stopped traffic because there had been a 18-wheeler turned over and it was just a mess. And so I did not like this album the very first time I listened to it. Now, I listened to it again, of course, on the way home from that trip. And it's about a 3.5-hour drive all said and done. And I ended up listening to the album either four or five times straight through, just it repeated again and again. And by the time I got home that Friday afternoon, I pretty much knew all the lyrics to every song on the album. And I was really enjoying the experience of listening to it. It's very catchy, and I understand why this one means so much to you and Megan. I can see the reasons that it would tie in to you guys emotionally and have some sort of attachment to it. I think Fink is a very solid talent. His voice sounds like the kind of narrator that you would want to narrate your life. He's powerful in his ability to write lyrics that look into his soul or your soul and penetrate to your deepest being. And I think it's a travesty that this album and Fink in generally are not more prevalent in our common vernacular. More people need to hear this album and actually experience it and what it has to offer for them personally. There are things that I'm not too overjoyed about on this album. There are a couple of songs that I felt did wallow in themselves a good deal. And there was a kind of hard to swallow edginess in a couple of the lyrics, to the point of being profane just to be profane, that I didn't really like. I think it could have been better or accomplished without having to go that far. All in all, though, this is a phenomenal album, Chris. This is one that I'm glad that is on your list and that you made me listen to. And I'm really glad that we had to take about a month off from recording so that I could really get to understand this album and have it be something constantly in my life for the last 4 or 5 weeks. That said, I'm going to give this album 5 out of 6 strings. I think it's great. And thank you.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad that you enjoyed it that much. So, you know, I've mentioned before on other episodes that music is kind of one of the first things that Megan and I bonded over. She introduced me to just a ton of bands that are now my favorite. And this album is really chief among them. We talked about Fink's previous career as a DJ. And I think that that really is the secret sauce. There's this like driving energy to a lot of these songs, even some of the slower jams, that keep it from getting sleepy. You know, music like this, poorly done, winds up just being boring. There are plenty of examples of like boring ho-hum alternative folk out there, and this is not one of them. You know, there are acoustic guitars, so that's folk-like. But they're nylon string. The chord voicings and progressions aren't the kind of things that you hear on the kind of Mumford and Sons knockoffs that I was moaning about. There's a lot more, I don't know, it's very, some of the chord progressions and harmonies are very jazzy. It's more sophisticated. It's all, I think, tied to his identity as a DJ and his background in electronic music. And, you know, this album isn't cheerful. It's not peppy, but I don't think it's necessarily hopeless either. I think the emotional tone of this album is complex, just like the relationships that Fink sings about in the lyrics. There are ups and downs, but they're all strained through Finn Greenall's unique aesthetic. You know, he's got such a unique perspective, musically speaking. And like I said at the onset of our discussion, for me, this album hasn't really aged a day since I was introduced to it. So I'm going to give it 6 out of 6 nylon, or, you know, if it was an old guitar, it could be, still be catgut. So 6 strings, whether they're from a cat or a nylon tree.
Very nice. Well, Chris, I think that almost wraps us up this week. I need to know what your favorite and least favorite track were.
Okay, so my favorite track, my absolute favorite track from this album is the tune Fear is Like Fire. You know, there's a lot of really easy cliches you can lean on as a songwriter. If you listen to like contemporary Christian music, you know that God is pretty much synonymous with water, mm-hmm. or waterfalls, or you know, God forbid, a hurricane. We won't get into that because it's a specific song I have a gripe with. But all his comparisons between fear and fire are interesting to me because it's not just, oh, fear will destroy your life. It's fear can motivate you. Mm-hmm. Fear can keep you warm, and it can, you know, it can burn the house down, as he says. And I also just think, like, the groove to it is really good. It kind of reminds me of, like, early Coldplay. Anything off of, like, Coldplay's second album, I think it kind of reminds me a lot of. And so I just really like it. That's definitely my favorite track. What about you? What was the track that got you the best on this album?
I really liked Warm Shadow. It has a great guitar riff kind of going throughout it. The lyrics are interesting to me, which is kind of funny because I've complained about repetitive lyrics, and the lyrics on this track are definitely repetitive.
Yeah.
But it works with the music, and I really liked the harmonies, the vocal harmonies that are going on throughout it. But I like the idea just of the song in terms of warm shadow, what you got in store for me, keep those eyes closed next to me. I don't want another day to break, take our steel, our night away, warm shadow, won't you cast yourself on me? And it just is kind of a cool thought. I enjoyed.
Yeah. It's a very interesting, like, it's kind of a weird mercurial love song,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's kind of, you know, I don't always like when people just mash together contradictory images just to be cool. But, like, Warm Shadow is a very interesting, you know, shadows are often cold, but it goes right up to the line of being like moody teenager stuff, but yeah. He reels it back just enough. And I like that song as well. I like that one a lot.
So what was your least favorite?
So this was really hard because I genuinely enjoy every song on this album. But if I had to pick an album that I like skip occasionally because I'm just not that interested in it, it would probably be Save It for Somebody Else. It's the only track on the album that I would describe as like kind of sleepy, like a little kind of just ho-hum, doesn't really go anywhere that much. But man, I do love Finn Greenell's voice on that track. So yeah. It's hard for me to say like, oh, it's my least favorite, but if I had to pick one, that would be it. Your least favorite track is one of my favorite tunes. Why don't you talk about that? Because it hurt my heart to read your show notes.
So the track is Honesty. And yeah. It's just one of those tracks that I did not connect with at all.
Yeah.
And I have a thing about glorifying terrible relationships or whatever. And even though the song isn't necessarily like an explicitly abusive relationship or anything like that, it's just one of those songs that does not have a redeeming quality in the story it's telling, and was hard for me to just stomach and be like, okay, this is great. So like you said, though, it was really hard for me to pick a track that I did not like on this album. And so this is the one, like you said earlier, that I found myself just skipping more often than not. And that's why I didn't hear the let me, you know, what was the line rebel again? I'm sorry.
Let me revel
in your blue. Like, I did not hear that because I skipped it most of the time. So I'll have to reevaluate that in a little while and see if this is still my least favorite track. But it was the easiest one for me to just put my finger on and say, that's the one I didn't like.
Yeah. I mean, if you didn't connect with it, you didn't connect with it. That's, you know.
So there's nothing against you or the track, really. Just it's not mine.
I never take any of this personally. I do think it's funny, though. We have talked about how some of the music I listen to is mopey. He literally says the phrase, woe is me, in that song. So as if you needed one more reason to dislike it. It's a little on the nose, Finn.
All right, man. Well, that's awesome. So I think it's time we figure out what we're doing with the Oracle this week.
Yeah, let's consult the Oracle.
All right. So we're picking from my list, which is down to 22 albums. I'm going to have to refresh it here before too long.
Yeah. So whittling it down.
Ooh, lucky number 13. Billy Joel's 1973 album, Piano Man.
All right.
So we're going relatively early in Billy Joel's career. We're not going to talk about his metal album, I promise, which is available on YouTube. Somebody ripped it from some old pressing, and it's terrible. But Piano Man's a great album, and I'm excited to share it with you next week.
So I just happened to be reading about Billy Joel the other day. And something I did not know, his very first album was pressed incorrectly by the record company and was like too fast. And so I listened to some of it and you can totally tell he sounds like a little chipmunk.
Yep.
What I read on Wikipedia was that he chucked the album down the block after listening to it because he was so mad. This is his second album, not his first, that we're doing today or next week. I mean,
exactly. No, it's going to be great. I'm going to have a lot of fun because I've got a lot of Billy Joel stories to tell. He is hands down my favorite musician and artist of all time. So don't be surprised if we hear more from him in the future, too, because I'm not letting him be around.
I'm down. I'm totally down. He is also, you could almost kind of think of him as the founding father of this whole thing, because I don't know how many conversations about his music we've had over the years. And we finally went, you know what, instead of just talking about this, why don't we record it and force it down people's ear holes?
Hey, people were always asking us what we thought about different music. So here we are. So if they don't want to listen, oh, well.
Well, it's free. So if they're listening and they shouldn't be, they're probably in Guantanamo Bay or something.
Oh, anyway. That's sad.
It means we're doing our part for American security. I don't know. I'm going to get us out of this. Okay, folks, thank you so much for listening. If you've been enjoying our show, please rate it and review it. We are definitely going to read reviews or comments on air because there's so few and far between. It is an event. Leave us a 1-star, a 5-star. I don't care, but leave us a review and we will bring it up on air.
Yeah, definitely, Chris. And if you want to get in touch with us, have an input on an episode or ideas for future episodes, shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com. Don't forget to hit us up on Instagram or Facebook. Tell us what you thought about Fink's Perfect Darkness album. And don't forget to tune in next Wednesday when we dim the lights, we light cigarettes, and we ask Mari at the bar to slide an old-fashioned our way while we talk about Billy Joel's Piano Man.